Thank you very much for the introduction. So I'm Ben Lefschetz, I work at Microsoft Research. This is another one of those papers from Microsoft Research that talks about JavaScript. So, oh, by the way, a public service announcement. US 1-0. Okay. So, on to the presentation. So, can you hear me well in the back? Do I need to stand close to this? Yes? Okay. So, by... Like this? Okay. I'll just stand over here. So, by way of introduction, let's look at an application that, you know, many of you have probably used, the mapping application, right? So, you're looking for a hotel like this one over here in Boston. You go to an application that looks kind of like this. And just do a simple search. So it looks like a very simple kind of innocent application, right? If you look under the covers, though, you'll see something quite fascinating. So this application has over 70,000 lines of JavaScript code that's being sent over to your web browser. This is a lot of code. This is a great deal of code. Speaking in networks, this is close to 3,000 functions. And speaking in networks terms, this is over 1 megabyte of code that travels over the network from the server to your browser. In addition to that, there are also other interesting effects. So this application talks to a variety of backend services, each of which might bring in even more code that is transmitted again to the browser, and makes that much more code for the web browser to process. And this is, again, a continuing theme. So we looked at a variety of applications representing different types of sites that are available out there. And we conclude that, you know, the majority of the download that you see is actually not images. It's not HTML. It's not cascading style sheets. It's actually code. So we see that in many cases, as much as 95% of the overall download is actually JavaScript code. Okay. Now, this is a bit of a problem. Why? So what is the reason behind Ajax? Why do we do this, you know, Web 2.0 stuff in the first place? The reason is to get greater end-user responsiveness, right? We move code to the client so that the application feels very responsive. The application doesn't have to, you know, make these round trips. But at the same time, given, you know, how much code we have, the execution cannot start, you know, before we transfer the code over. So that's really the catch-22. This is the vicious cycle that we are trying to break with JSApp. How do we make it so that the code is not as heavyweight as it is currently? So this is kind of your traditional picture. So client on the right and a server on the left over here, different colors. Let's look at what happens currently as you're transferring a piece of JavaScript code from the server to the client. So this is roughly the process, right? You start with your JavaScript, your favorite, you know, piece of JavaScript code. You apply some sort of minification or crunching to it to remove white spaces and do things of that nature. And then you apply gzip, which is the industry standard approach to compressing both text and code. This is what happens on the server, right, in your data center, or you might have a standalone server, what have you. Then you transmit this gzip information over to the client. What the client does is that it basically un-gzips it, right, and then it runs it through a JavaScript parser, and then eventually it constructs an abstract syntax tree, an AST, in the memory of the browser, which it proceeds to, you know, massage in some ways to convert it into bytecode and so on and so forth. This is quite a lengthy process, right? So if you consider this entire process end-to-end from the server to the client, I think you can see why this would be actually quite, something that slows things down. Right, so the end user experience is slowed down because this process has so many intricate steps. So in particular, really all we need to get out of this is some magical way to transform from a piece of JavaScript on the server to an AST that lives within the memory of the browser. If only we had this. Well, this is exactly what we are trying to do with JSApp. Right? So we are trying to construct a way to magically take JavaScript and kind of zap into the memory of the browser using abstract syntax trees or ASTs. So what do we do? How does this work? Well, the approach is actually fairly simple. So really the emphasis here is on ASTs versus source code. right? So if you think at what happens currently, basically JavaScript source code is treated exactly the same way text files are treated or HTML is treated, which we think is a bit of a mistake. Instead, we propose an AST-based representation which has nice benefits for compression. We take the AST on the server, we serialize it, and then we essentially decompress it directly into the browser memory on the client, if you will. Now, as part of this process, we always use gzip as a second-level compressor. So on top of JSZAP, we still use gzip because this is what browsers have anyway, and it runs pretty fast. It's written in C, it's highly optimized, blah, blah, blah. So we kind of use it to pick up on the inefficiencies that JSZAP might have introduced, right? So we are not kind of saying no to gzip, but we are trying to do better than gzip does currently. So speaking of AST-based compression, what are the benefits? Well, the benefits, I think, are threefold. So first of all, the latency is reduced. JSZAP is compressing better than gzip does, which means that there is less data to transmit, and because of that, the end-user latency is reduced. And the second benefit is that ASTs are created directly in the browser instead of going through this laborious parsing step, which is really not needed. That's the first benefit. The second benefit is that we're also reducing network bandwidth, right? We're transmitting fewer bytes. That means that for the user, they're paying less if they're on a mobile connection that charges them per byte. Also for the server, for the data center, they're paying less because, well, if they have millions and millions of users like Facebook does, they're paying less to the network provider for that network capacity. Now, the third benefit is slightly less obvious. We also get benefits in the space of correctness and security. Why is that? Well, one pretty obvious benefit, in fact, is that if we are transmitting ASTs, we also ensure that the code is well-formed, which is kind of nice, right? If the code is poorly formed, if the code is broken and the JavaScript browser cannot parse it in the first place, well, you might wonder why transmit it at all. So this AST-based approach ensures that the code is well-formed. It actually goes beyond that. So you can do quite elaborate things. Like, for instance, many of you have probably heard of EdSafe, which is an approach to subsetting language, the JavaScript language for security. Well, once you have this AST-based representation, turns out that it's actually pretty easy to do this kind of subsetting. There are other interesting applications. Like, for instance, you can look at your AST representation and very quickly conclude that there is no blocking execution there, so your HTML parser doesn't have to block on that piece of code and can proceed further. And again, that has very nice benefits in this case for unblocking the pipeline between the server and the user. And I'll talk about some of these benefits more in detail later. Okay, so JSZAP. So, well, so far so good. So here's what happens on the server, right? We start with JavaScript. We go through this JSZAP process, and then we have the secondary gzipping step. The JSZAP process essentially looks like this. We take the program, right, the code, we parse it, and break it down into three streams. The first one is productions, as you would have productions in a grammar for just about any language. The second one is identifiers, the way they're found in your program. And the third one, the last one, is literals, things like strings, numerals, so on and so forth. And then all of these streams, we have different strategies for compressing each one of those. And once we've done that, we put them together and gzip the result to kind of get the final JSZAP output. Now, some of you are probably fans of Stephen Colbert. Anybody? Anyone? Yes? Yes. Thank you. So turns out that, well, you know, this sounds like an interesting plan, but... You know, and we started this in the beginning of last summer, kind of thinking along these lines, but turned out to be amazingly difficult to beat gzip. Gzip is kind of this blunt tool, but it's also, I mean, it compresses both text and code remarkably well. So at the end of the day, as you'll see from my final results, we do better than gzip does, but it took us actually quite a while to get to this point. So here's an example of what happens, from looking at one of the files that comes from Facebook. So looking at these different streams, productions, identifiers, and literals, we see that if we start with gzip, we'll get some compression. So basically, JSZAP over here on the right results in a smaller overall size compared to gzip over here. And then individual parts, so in this case, this would be the productions, this would be the identifiers, and this would be the literals, each of them is smaller than what you get with gzip, right? This is how we get better compression numbers. But again, like I said earlier, it turns out to be remarkably difficult to get to that point. And so talking about productions, identifiers, and literals is really kind of the, you know, the majority of this presentation. I'm going to talk about what we do with each of these streams in turn, and then I'll kind of sum up by looking at evaluation numbers that we get by applying JSAP to real code. Okay, so before I go into the technical details, let me give you a little bit more background. So, you know, just so we're on the same page, I'm sure you've seen this before, but just so we're on the same page, AST, subtract syntax trees, right? So suppose you have a simple expression that kind of looks like this, A times B plus C. You have a grammar for parsing this expression. In this case, this is a very, very simple grammar over here in the middle. So it has some terms, it has multiplication, addition, blah, blah, blah. And then we have a parse tree that looks like that, right? And so this is what, you know, your compiler, your runtime would have in its memory when it encounters an expression like this. And then basically, you know, there is a correspondence between the parse tree on the right and the grammar over here in the middle, right? So production rule number 5 kicks in for the leaves of the tree, and that corresponds to taking something and turning it into an identifier, and then other rules kick in. So rule number 3 over here corresponds to multiplication, and then rule number 1 corresponds to addition. Okay, so this is just to kind of refresh your memory. Now, if you look at a slightly bigger program, something like this, this is actually a very small JavaScript program. Once you kind of break it down, once you follow what the parser does, you'll find the following three streams. So first, you'll see the production streams, a variety of productions for slightly more complicated grammar. We'll basically go into that. The second stream is the stream of identifiers, and you see identifiers that come directly from the program, things like, you know, y for variable y, foo for function foo, x for variable x, and so on and so forth, in the order after that they encountered the program. And the very last stream is the literal stream. So they will have constant strings like JSCrunch in this case and JSZap, as well as numerals like 2, 3, and so forth. So these are the three streams that we want to focus on. And in this presentation, I'm going to sort of combine our experimental results with a sort of technical description. So let me kind of present our benchmarks that we used for JSZap. So we use about, I think, 10 different benchmarks. They range in terms of their size from about 1,000 lines of code to about 22,000 lines of code. So this is pretty substantial amounts of JavaScript. This is kind of taking a single file of a particular application, like, for instance, Facebook or Bing Maps or Live Messenger or Bing itself or some other type of code like that, and trying to run it through the compressor. And we also have information about how many bytes the initial source contains. So they go from basically about 17 kilobytes to over half a megabyte in size. Okay? So something to point out is that, you know, there's kind of a variety of application types over here. So there's a search engine, there are office applications, there are mapping applications, Facebook, and so on and so forth. We thought this was kind of important. Now, some of these are written by hand, and others are automatically generated, right? So for instance, basically the Microsoft applications on this slide are going to be generated automatically using this tool that they use called ScriptSharp. So we wanted to have a mix of both to kind of, you know, because in reality, some applications out there are handwritten and others are generated. And, I mean, the other point I wanted to make before I go any further is that basically for all the numbers we are going to see here, unless I say otherwise, everything is going to be gzip. I mean, basically, we don't really look at uncompressed numbers. It kind of doesn't make sense because gzip comes as a built-in feature with just about any browser these days. Okay, so once we kind of break our benchmarks down into these three streams, productions, identifiers, and literals, this is kind of the breakdown that we get. Okay, so again, this is all color-coded. Something to point out about this is that pretty much all of these categories turned out to be important. It's really not the case that, you know, in one of these benchmarks, like there are no literals and no identifiers. That would be kind of silly. They are all present, which means that we really need to focus on all of them to get good results. Now, another thing that's kind of interesting is that, you know, the bigger your code becomes, the more identifiers you get, which is really only natural, right? So for large budgets of code, we really need to focus on compressing identifiers in particular. Okay, so the first thing I'm going to talk about is productions, compressing the production stream. And I'm going to mention some of the techniques that we use. I'll refer you to the paper for sort of a more detailed description and exactly how we put them all together. You know, please read the paper for that. So the first trick that we use is this thing called frequency-based production renaming. So basically the idea is that not all productions in the production stream are used with the same frequency, and it makes sense to rename these numbers so that the ones that are used most often have the lowest number, right? Simple trick turns out to be actually fairly effective in practice, just to give you a sense of what's going on. Another one, similar to the first one, is what's called differential encoding. So for instance, if you use productions 26 and 57 all the time, well, those are big numbers and there is really kind of no rhyme or reason to them. We might as well rename them to things like 2 and 3 that are small numbers, easier to compress, you know, become a result in much smaller representations. Another thing that turns out to be quite effective is this chain rule optimization. So we look at the grammar and conclude that basically if there is no way, if you have two productions that are always followed by a particular third production, which is perfectly predictable, there is really no way to kind of include it because, again, it's perfectly predictable. So you might as well omit it. And looking for opportunities like that results in pretty good space savings. The last one, which turns out to be actually most effective for compressing production, is what we call a tree-based prediction by partial match. And I'll tell you about it in just a second. So here's what it is. So consider compressing a piece of code like this. So if you have if P, then X, else, I should say Y, not else X. That's kind of silly, though. Anyway, so suppose you have actually a piece of code that looks like, you know, let's kind of instantiate this. So suppose you have if P, then, you know, blah, 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 and then you have ABC followed by something else, and then there's another ABC. So again, there's this repetition ABC, and the idea is that, you know, something like gzip should be able to pick up on this pattern on ABC and represent it as some symbol in its compression dictionary, and everything will be great. And actually, for a while, it will be, unless you get to really large bodies of code. So the problem is that if the then branch of this is really quite long, then by the time it gets, gzip gets to the else branch, it will have forgotten about, you know, common patterns in the then branch. And that's kind of unfortunate because it's not going to be able to pick up on this kind of redundancy. Well, it turns out that there is actually a much better approach that this is what we use in JSZAP. So this is what gzip would do for small patterns. But it turns out that, you know, looking at this as an AST, as a tree, is actually much better. So the idea is that we essentially use this notion of a tree context to build a predictor. So essentially, if you have some, you know, tree context, so you are sitting there at this node P, and then you're seeing X, you know, your tree context might be P and the parent of P, as well as the number of the child. And that turns out to be actually a much better predictor in practice than the simple-minded scheme that, you know, gzip uses in this case to compress text. We use other tricks there, so we use this form of arithmetic coding to essentially, you know, sort things by frequency again. So more likely productions will get shorter identifiers and things of that sort. See paper for details. So it turns out that this is actually fairly effective. So this is the kind of compression numbers we get with this scheme, which is basically we go from 100% to these numbers. And these numbers kind of are, you know, in the 75% range. For Facebook, which is highlighted over there, because the keynote speaker, they get, you know, to be picked on, we go from 100% to 68%. So this is pretty significant compression right there out of the scheme compared to what gzip would do, right? Always the best baseline for these comparisons is kind of plain gzip. Okay, good. The second part of this is compressing the identifier stream. So remember, we have things like X and Y and Z and various identifiers you would use in your program, in your source program. And the challenge is, well, how do you compress this identifier stream? So it turns out that there's quite a bit of repetition in this identifier stream just because you use your identifiers all the time as you write your program, right? So it turns out that it's much better to use a symbol table instead of a flat stream because that will take care of this redundancy. Now, when it comes to constructing a symbol table, well, there are several approaches we consider. So you can imagine having a global symbol table that will just use a giant hash map for the entire program. And that turns out to be not particularly effective just because there are so many identifiers. Another approach is to use local symbol tables, right, that would kind of, you know, have essentially this notion of hierarchical hash tables and offsets within those, and that turns out to be considerably more effective, as we discussed in the paper. Other tricks we use is, you know, sorting symbols by their frequencies, all this, as well as renaming local variables, right? If they're just local variables, then their names do not really matter. Just like in Java, you can call them, you know, $1, $2, and so on and so forth, if you can do analysis and conclude that their names are immaterial. So what we actually use in practice to get best results is this variable length encoding scheme for identifiers. And this is roughly how it proceeds. This is a bit of a kind of cartoonish sketch, but this gives you some idea of what's going on in practice, which is, first of all, if it's a global variable, we ask, well, does it fit in one byte? And if so, we use one prefix for that to kind of only look one byte ahead. And then if it doesn't, then we use a different prefix to indicate that we'll actually need two bytes to encode that particular identifier. If it's not a global, if it's a local variable, then, well, is that something that can be safely renamed? And if so, this is, again, one kind of particular prefix, and if not, it's a different prefix. So this gives you some idea of how this works. And it turns out that if you look in practice, you know, all of these cases actually occur. The most prominent cases, the most common cases, are one byte globals, shown here in blue, as well as kind of local buildings, locals whose names do not really matter. And for those, we use kind of the shortest encoding because, as we see from this chart over here, they occur sort of most frequently in practice. How effective is this? Well, it turns out to be pretty effective. Again, we go from 100% to something like the 90%, 80%. So picking on Facebook again. So global symbol tables alone will take us from 100% just for gzip to about 94%. And if you use our variable length encoding, what I just described a slide ago, then we'll go from 100% to 89%. Turns out to be actually fairly important in practice. The last bit is literals. Let me skip that. It's in the paper. So, the average compression we get with JSZAP is on the order of 10%. So picking on Facebook, we get about 12% compression compared to what gzip can deliver, which we think is actually fairly good given how much code there is out there being transmitted on the wire every single time you go to just about any page out there. What is responsible for these savings? If we look into the Facebook number in a little bit more detail, what is responsible for these 12-13% savings? Turns out that, you know, 26% of the savings come from production compression, 57% come from identifiers, and then the remainder comes from literals. So compressing each one of these streams is important, as I mentioned earlier. So in summary, JSZAP is an AST-based compression scheme for JavaScript. We propose a variety of techniques that focus on compressing productions, identifiers, and literals sort of separately and then putting the results together. The preliminary results so far are fairly encouraging. We get on the order of 10% savings over what we get, you know, out of the box with gzip. Now, future focus is really on measuring latency. I mean, our goal is to build this into a browser and figure out how much, you know, this gives us by way of end-to-end savings. Because, you know, we talk to browser manufacturers these days, and they say that if you look at overall JavaScript execution time, it could be as much as 20%, that's the parsing time. Now, with JSZAP, we essentially get rid of much of the parsing time because we transmit ASTs that do not need to be parsed. So this is really quite encouraging. It means that hopefully the end-to-end savings will be even more significant than we see just out of raw compression. Now, let me leave you with this vision. So AST representations is actually quite a powerful technique, quite a powerful idea. This presentation covers JSZAP, which is a technique for doing compression. But there are tons of other applications of these, of ASTs. And so I mentioned some of them again already, but let me kind of go over through them and take just a minute here. So another one is, doing things like caching incremental updates. So currently, if you have a small change to a JavaScript file, like your jQuery, for instance, you will have to pretty much retransmit the entire thing. Well, this is kind of silly if you only changed one function. With AST-based representations, you can actually afford to transmit just a single function. That's great. You can do things like unblocking, the HTML parser, which is already something I mentioned. You can do, check for the well-formedness of your input. You can do security checking like AdSafe, and maybe more elaborate schemes as well. And, what have you. I mean, the possibilities are not entirely endless, but certainly they exist. This is all I have. I'm happy to take a few questions.
Dan Peek, Facebook. So why is AST the right level to do things? I mean, could we instead do work on bytecode? Could we work on different optimizations that would save space? Why this particular level?
Well, this is a good question. So one of the benefits of the AST is that it's more or less standardized. Not kind of entirely, but more or less. Just because the language is pretty much standard. There's a standard for the language. Getting to an AST is a very small step. Going to bytecode, I think there will be a lot of discussion over which bytecode to use. Is it going to be the IE bytecode, the Firefox bytecode, the Chrome bytecode, what have you. And looking at AST is actually a relatively neutral way to proceed. And it gives us, all the benefits outlined in this slide. So it's actually not a bad way to go.
One, two from Georgia Tech. I have a question. So do you have any idea what's the performance trade-off of this compressing the code, and how much time spent on parsing the AST tree?
Not yet. So we don't really care about the time it takes on the server, right? It's really client time that we worry about. And so at this point, we are still kind of experimenting with these things. We don't, unfortunately, do not yet have final numbers on that.
Okay, thanks.
Hi, John Howell, Microsoft Research, just down the hall from you. It seems like several of the pieces of the optimization you described look like your own implementation of essentially the Huffman coding, right? You said, here's some large or repeated features, and we'll encode those, which is why it wasn't too surprising that then GZIP is competitive. So can you call attention to the part? You did call attention to one place where you do something GZIP doesn't do, which is you essentially have a larger dictionary for the tree matching. What were some of the other? That's a place where GZIP falls over. It isn't able to remember long enough. What were the other features of your compression that are doing something that GZIP can't do naturally in sort of this structure oblivious way?
Yeah, I think the sort of tree-based predictive matcher is probably the most prominent example where structure really matters. Text is kind of immaterial. I would say that's probably the most kind of prominent example of them all. The second example, I would say, is that the fact that if we can rename locals, we can get a lot of mileage out of that, right? So if you know that your variable foobar, foobar, bar, 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 doesn't really need to be named that. It can be something very, very short, like A, B, or C.
Right, but I mean, Huffman coding is going to do exactly that, right? It's going to...
It depends on your window size. The window size in GZIP is not unlimited.
Okay. Thanks.
So if you crank it up, you can actually get more mileage out of it. By default, perhaps not as much.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Last question. Oh, So as a quick follow-up, did you? Sure. So you're using the default settings for gzip. What happens if you do crank the window size up? I mean, modern computers, there's no really reason why it has to be 32K or whatever it is.
Good question. So which setting did we use ultimately for these?
We use the default. I think we use the same setting that the browsers use, though. So basically, that's the thing. You have to agree on what's available. So the content encoding uses the current setting. That's what we use.
So one of the issues is that while it's possible to use like really powerful encoding schemes, not all of them are supported by decoders, which are browsers. So we cannot really kind of, you see what I mean?
Well, but neither is yours, right?
Well, not yet.